Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wouldn't it be nice to never worry about money? Maybe even quit your job, work for yourself. Doesn't mean you have to be a billionaire, though most of us wouldn't complain, but just enough to truly consider yourself financially independent. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. So glad to have you with us on this Independence Day, Wednesday, the 4th of July. For most of today's show, we'll be talking about financial independence, but first, the news of the day. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says Britain will step up security checks on highly skilled immigrant workers. The decision comes days after bomb scares in London and Glasgow, in which the suspects are doctors from the Middle East and India. But what effect could this greater scrutiny have on a British economy dependent on foreigners? Here's Marketplace's Dan Gretsch.
Britain's already a magnet for skilled immigrants, including an estimated 90,000 foreign doctors. That leaves critics saying Prime Minister Brown's crackdown may come too late.
That would seem a little bit like closing the door after the horse has bolted.
Ashley Seeger covers economics for The Guardian, a British newspaper. He says Britain's borders are wide open to workers from the European Union, Australia, and former British colonies. But after two terror attacks in 3 years, the attitude towards immigrants has shifted.
Britain has always prided itself on being an open country with liberal values. But those liberal values are going to be sorely tested in the coming years.
Rhian Bainon is with the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants. She says tighter borders carry an economic impact.
We're very reliant, or increasingly reliant, on labour from countries like Poland. But we have to recognise that if people think that the system is sufficiently difficult, then they may very well be deterred from entering the UK.
She says skilled foreigners could simply go to countries with more relaxed borders. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The barbarians at the gate are about to open their doors, at least some of them, to the investing public. The private equity firm Kohlberg Kravis Roberts says it's hoping to raise $1.25 billion in an IPO. KKR is well known from its leveraged buyout streak in the 80s, which included the purchase of RJR Nabisco. The move comes on the heels of rival Blackstone Group's public offering, which jumped more than 13% in its first day of trading. Jeremy Hobson reports from Washington on the rush to go public now.
KKR follows the lead of Blackstone Group, which went public 2 weeks ago. Its founders took home $2.5 billion, but Blackstone shares have dropped more than 4% since then. Kevin Hassett, director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, says that has a lot to do with concern about new taxes being considered in Congress.
If we took any firm, you know, be it Exxon or General Electric, and then had Congress considering a law change that specifically increased their tax rate, then you wouldn't be surprised if their price went down.
But then why would KKR want to go public now, given all the uncertainty about taxes? Victor Fleischer focuses on private equity at the University of Illinois Law School.
Get a valuation while the tax risk is still uncertain and before Congress acts to change the tax treatment, which would depress the valuation of the firms.
Fleischer says KKR's owners stand to gain quite a bit if and when they cash out. The firm's assets have ballooned to $53 billion from just $18 billion 5 years ago. KKR says it hopes to complete the proposed IPO later this year. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Wall Street took the day off, but the rest of the world didn't. We'll have overseas details when we do the numbers.
We'll be right back.
exactly does financial independence mean? That you're fabulously wealthy and never have to worry about a thing? That you can simply support yourself without help from mom and dad? That you have no debt? Does that include no mortgage? Today, we're going to explore the different ways people create financial independence under various definitions. First, Marketplace's Amy Scott takes a look at a new way to borrow and lend that doesn't slap on huge interest charges.
Stop wasting my time.
Let's say I could really use some money, but my credit isn't so hot and I've got some unpaid bills. I could try to get a bank loan. Not likely. I could go to one of those payday loan centers and pay a few 100% interest. Or I could go to Prosper.com.
Give me some money. Give me some money.
Prosper is one of a few so-called peer-to-peer lending sites. It matches people who need money with those who have it. Take Tori Shannon. She wanted to pay off some debt and expand her lingerie business, so she posted a profile on the website. She described her loan request and how she planned to pay it back. The profile also listed her credit grade, high risk, and explained why. Her husband had been seriously wounded in Iraq, and she had a bankruptcy in her past. But she was willing to pay 22% interest. Lenders then had a chance to bid on Shannon's loan in increments as small as $50. Eventually, more than 30 people lent her a total of $6,000.
For me to go into a bank, they would probably give me 15 minutes of their time, determine that I'm not a good risk, and say, sorry, can't help you. Whereas on Prosper, it would be a situation, well, tell me a little bit more about it. What exactly happened? Okay, how are you going to prevent that from happening again?
It seems fitting that Prosper's headquarters in San Francisco are down the street from Charles Schwab, the company famous for democratizing investing. Prosper founder Chris Larson says he wanted to do for the consumer debt market what eBay had done for commerce.
It's really kind of giving the power of underwriting, the power of where does capital get allocated directly to individuals.
Individuals like Perry Heinrich. He's a software engineer from Baltimore. Heinrich has lent about $1,000 on Prosper to 21 different borrowers. The site recommends making small loans to several people to spread the risk around. Heinrich admits he was first attracted by the handsome interest rates, but what's really got him hooked is helping people down on their luck.
If you put your money in a CD or a money market fund, you can earn 5% at a bank. And if your neighbor down the street is paying, you know, 15 or 20 or 30% on their credit cards, this provides an interesting avenue where borrowers and lenders can help one another out and bypass the whole banking system.
It does take a lot of faith, though. Heinrich says out of his 21 borrowers, 5 are behind on their payments. Prosper provides a collection service if things get out of hand. So far, its members have loaned a total of more than $70 million. About 3% of those loans are at least 3 months late. Even the most compelling cases can't always live up to their promises. That's why lender Carl Waldman says he doesn't even read borrowers' stories. He has the system bid automatically on loans that match a certain profile.
Because there's no way to verify what they put on the webpage. It's not even worth the time to read it.
Back in her dining room slash office, Tori Shannon shows off the fruits of her Prosper loan.
This is a cupless corset. There's no coverage in certain areas.
The corset is one of the products she sells on her website. So far, Shannon is living up to her promise. She's fallen behind on her payments a few times, but managed to catch up again. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So that's one way to borrow and lend to people in this country. What about lending to people in other parts of the world, those who would otherwise have a tough time gaining any semblance of financial independence? You've probably heard of the concept of microfinancing. Banks and other financial outlets lend small amounts of money to people in the developing world who are too poor to get a traditional loan. But several organizations, like Kiva.org, now allow you to become a microlender. You go on a website, pick what project you want to finance, and in 6 months or a year, you get your money back. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof recently wrote about some loans that he's made, so we invited him to talk about the experience.
Well, this kind of fit into a few things that I've been interested in. One is microcredit, which I've seen in a lot of countries and I'm incredibly impressed by. And the other is connecting donors directly with projects at a very local level. And frankly, also, I always get asked by people, you know, so what can I do? So partly out of kind of impatience of that, I thought, well, I'll give them an example and I'll take it for a test drive. And so I made small loans to a few people on Kiva. And then later when I went to Afghanistan, where I had lent to two people, I thought I'd pay those people a visit.
Tell us a little bit about that visit and who you met and what kind of enterprise you were funding at that point.
Sure. Well, I had lent $25 each to two people, Abdul Sattar, who's a baker, and Abdul Sabur, who runs a little electronic shop. So I show up in this, you know, poor neighborhood in Kabul, and the baker, Abdul Sattar, I mean, he didn't know what the internet was. He'd never been on a computer. And, you know, all of a sudden, I show up and, I explain I'm his banker. but he took it in stride, and he understood that he was getting these loans from foreigners through some kind of newfangled way. So he then bribed me with like a dozen loaves of bread that he just baked. And boy, they were good. That was my credit analysis.
Well, so what had your $25 done for him? Because certainly we as Americans thinking about $25, it's hard to imagine that would go very far.
Sure. In each case, my money was pooled with that of other people.
What was the total that had been given to or loaned to Mr. Sattar?
I think it was about $425. And he had used that to buy supplies in bulk so that he didn't have to go every day to the market, and also to open up another bakery. Mm-hmm. The other person that I'd lent to, this fellow running an electronics shop, it was even more striking, the gain that he'd had, because, you know, before, when he didn't have any working capital, he had to go every day to the marketplace to buy spare parts to fix televisions. And by getting a little bit of working capital, he would make one trip every 2 weeks or one trip a month. And with that inventory, he was able to use his time to repair TVs instead of to travel, and to spend much less money on transportation.
How does this kind of very personal microfinancing work? From the time that you make a donation or make a loan — I keep calling it a donation, it's really a loan.
No, I mean, it really is a loan. And that really is part of the idea, that you're teaching people business practices, that you're cultivating entrepreneurs rather than just beneficiaries.
So how does it actually work?
It depends on which microcredit group you're talking about. Uh-huh. Kiva does not have any employees in Afghanistan, for example, but they work with a local group in Afghanistan called Ariana Financial Services, which is run by this just incredibly dynamic young woman. Kiva supplies the lenders, and she supplies the borrowers.
So what's the benefit to you of doing this?
A couple of different things. I mean, it is a way of feeling like you're making a difference, of doing so in a way that encourages economic activity, which ultimately will provide more employment, mm-hmm, to support the economy. I also think that there's really a benefit, though, of just engaging with the rest of the world and of seeing who you are helping. And, you know, in this case, I happen to lend to two men, but that is actually unusual in microcredit. Usually the borrowers are women, and one central purpose of microcredit has been to raise the status of women in the developing world.
Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for The New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us and for really shedding some light on a very interesting way to spread your money around the world.
Thank you. And I think your listeners would actually have a lot of fun spreading their money around in this way.
Well, let's consider that a challenge. Thanks again.
Take care.
And we have a link to some of those microlenders on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, Mom and Dad, eventually you're going to have the talk. How to tell your offspring we're loaded.
It's really important that we help our kids learn to become responsible citizens. Rather than grow up with an attitude of greed or griping, we help them grow up with an attitude of gratitude.
But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed for the holiday today, but the rest of the world was up and running and generating some fireworks. London's FTSE rose 0.2%. In Germany, the DAX closed up 0.4%. The CAC 40 in Paris tacked on 0.3%. The CEO of Coca-Cola told Reuters today that the company is mulling a bid for Snapple iced tea. It's currently owned by Cadbury Schweppes. Some international hotel groups saw a bump from yesterday's news that the private equity group Blackstone is buying Hilton Hotels in a $26 billion deal. French hotelier Accor jumped 7.5%, and Intercontinental Hotels gained just over 5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Education Association wraps up its annual meeting in Philadelphia. Lots of naked people run through the streets of Pamplona to protest the upcoming running of the bulls. The running of the nudes is a less dangerous option for those looking to participate. And actress Edie Falco of Sopranos fame celebrates her birthday. She'll be 44. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Here's a sure way to gain financial independence. Win the lottery. I admit I play every once in a while. I know the odds, but who hasn't dreamed of accepting one of those 5-foot fake checks with their name scrawled across it with a number that includes lots and lots of zeros? Well, most winners have some idea of how they're going to spend the money. A new car, a new house, a charitable donation or two. But one lucky lotto player took his winnings to the bank and to his hometown in Pakistan, Miranda Kennedy reports.
Ihsan Khan was raised by subsistence farmers in a hut in the impoverished Himalayan town of Batagram. But when he was 18, he scored his first break, a visa to America. He went to Chicago and later D.C. For the next 20 years, he scraped together a living as a security guard and a cab driver. And then one night, he had a very American dream.
This was something that I saw too many beautiful things, like rubies, diamond, and then I'm speaking to a lot of people, way too big of a crowd, and then this number, 246-1725, Powerball 31.
He played those numbers for 10 years, and then it paid off. The Pakistani taxi driver hit a $55 million Powerball jackpot. When he found out, he gave one last cab ride for free. Then he bought himself a Mercedes 600 and a couple million-dollar mansions in Virginia and Islamabad. But his next move was less predictable. He went back to his hometown and ran for mayor. Call it the ultimate remittance.
It's not that you go and pile up money and money and forget about other. You still, everybody has a responsibility or some sort of obligation to the people a little less fortune.
Khan's mayoral opponents tried to cut him down by dubbing him the American Dollar Man. But if anything, the dollar value helped. He was elected last October. 2 days later, a devastating earthquake hit Pakistan. It killed 3,000 citizens of Batagram. Mayor Khan rose to the occasion. He was able to bypass the government's inefficient bureaucracy by dipping directly into his jackpot. He handed out $300,000 worth of medicine and roofing materials. Khan takes me to a camp for earthquake survivors in Batagram.
Like here, you could see this is for help. Somebody's sitting here. And then there is a...
To offer medical services?
Yeah, and there is some school and playground for the children. And
He's not happy with the thin plastic sheets that serve as home for the thousands stranded here, but other than giving away cash, he's powerless to improve things. So it frustrates him when earthquake victims demand more help. As Khan tries to leave the camp, he's literally mobbed by survivors. One man blocks him from getting into his Land Cruiser.
He said, what the government's going to give us when we go back? So I say, food, shelter, stove, blanket, mattresses.
Was he saying that because he didn't know or he wasn't satisfied with what he's going to get?
No, I think he's not satisfied. Everybody wants more. This is how it works, more and more.
Khan says even before he was a multi-millionaire mayor, he didn't think much of welfare. But now that he's loaded, he says he's realized two things about money, that everyone's greedy for it and that it can't always fix everything. In Batagram, Pakistan, I'm Miranda Kennedy for Marketplace.
So winning the lottery is one way to assure your financial independence. Another is to grow up rich. But the wealthy have their own problems. Problems the rest of us wouldn't mind having, but problems nonetheless, I guess. Like, when's the right time to tell your kids you're rich? A recent survey commissioned by PNC Wealth Management asked 1,500 wealthy Americans that question, and a lot of others about wealth and parenting. The results show that a lot of moneyed moms and dads tend to duck the issue, possibly to the detriment of their sons and daughters. Oh, no. Marketplace's Sean Cole has our story.
For the purposes of the survey, wealthy is defined as having investable assets of $500,000 to $10 million or more. And while $500,000 might not seem wealthy in this day and age, it's enough to make some parents all squirrely around their kids. About 40% of parents surveyed said you should wait until your kids are 21 before talking to them about the family estate. And about 9% of those folks said you should wait until they're 31.
It's too late, in my judgment.
This is Bruce Bickle, Senior Vice President of PNC Wealth Management. He helps family foundations manage their assets, but what they really need, he says, is help managing their lives. For instance, he says kids should start learning how rich they are and how to manage wealth when they're still in grade school. But a lot of parents just don't know how to bring it up.
The way I start out, you know, is to take a pie, for instance, with young children and say, we're going to show you where mommy and daddy spend our money. And you cut it in different slivers and say, now this is how much we pay for our house. And this is how much we spend on our clothes.
Then give them an allowance, he says, and teach them how to slice that pie up, always leaving some aside for charity. You should also encourage your kids to get an after-school job, he says, and to differentiate between what they need and what they want. All of this will prevent kids from growing up feeling entitled, he says, which is exactly what 45% of parents in the survey are worried about.
It's really important that we help our kids learn to become responsible citizens. Rather than grow up with an attitude of greed or griping, we help them grow up with an attitude of gratitude.
Which is quite a platitude. The question is, how do you even hide the fact that you're rich from your kids, especially if you're really rich?
I remember, you know, being picked up from school to go on holidays in a limousine, being this huge thing. I remember being so...
This is gaming heir Luke Wheel being interviewed in a documentary called Born Rich. He's one of 10 heirs and heiresses that appear in the film, all from families that make $10 million look like lunch money. The film was made by Jamie Johnson, as in Johnson & Johnson. He says in the movie that he grew up in a big house in the country, but he didn't learn how rich he was from his parents.
I was 10 years old. It was in fourth grade. During a free reading period in the library, a kid in my class found my dad's name in a copy of Forbes magazine with a list of the 400 richest people in America.
I got a hold of Johnson at his office in Manhattan. He says rich parents who don't tell their kids how to handle money early on can end up with messed up kids, as evidenced by this moment in the film.
Have you ever had an encounter that rubs you the wrong way? And I'm up at boarding school, and this kid's from like some town in Connecticut, you know, I don't know. I can just say, you, I'm from New York. I can buy your family, piss off.
I think parenting is a huge problem amongst rich families. I think that when you have someone saying things like, off, I can buy your ass, that becomes an issue of parenting.
The thing is, the majority of parents in the survey said being open with their children about finances was important, but more than half have never discussed the responsibility that comes with family wealth. One parent who doesn't talk much about money with her kids is Lucy. She didn't want her last name used.
Well, I just don't like to be very public with finances.
Lucy has two kids, 18 and 20. The family is worth more than $50 million from when her husband's telecommunications company went public. But she says her kids learn by example because the family doesn't live extravagantly.
Well, that's a little bit not true. We do have probably a few more houses than we can properly deal with. But
How many is a few more than you can deal with?
Well, let's see. We have five houses, I guess, effectively.
Both of her kids have had summer jobs. Then again, each of them also has a car and a charge card.
I mean, I haven't been good in training them about money. You know, when they need something that seems reasonable, I guess they get it, but they don't spend exorbitantly.
When you say, I guess they get it, you mean you give it to them?
Yes.
And she says no sometimes, but that no doesn't always stick. Again, Bruce Bickle of PNC.
The reason most people don't want to say no is because they don't want to disappoint the kids.
Is it me? I feel like these are wonderful problems for people to have.
But I think, Sean, you'd be surprised how the families say, you know, this is really difficult.
But I mean, I'm just like, oh, poor baby. You know, I mean, like...
Well, I'm with you. I understand that. But we are essentially our brother's keeper in that regard. And how is it that we can help the next generation become more responsible individual families? And when you have more individual responsible families, you're going to have a more individually responsible community and a city and a state and hopefully a nation and a world.
So you're trying to lower the population of spoiled brats in the world.
Good statement. That's a good summary statement. Lower the population of spoiled brats.
After all, fewer spoiled brats, fewer people telling you that they could buy your family. In all fairness, the kid who said that in the documentary admitted that it was petty and underhanded. But it's so easy, he said. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, with all the recent talk about high-profile IPOs, here's one that may grant investors the keys to the kingdom, in a matter of speaking. Today, Saudi billionaire Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal unveiled plans to hold a public offering for his kingdom holding company on the Saudi Stock Exchange. Many Saudis may ignore the IPO because of worries it doesn't comply with Islamic monetary traditions, but other buyers could be attracted to the Kingdom Holding Company's 17% investment in a Magic Kingdom, Euro Disney. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media for this July 4th. Today, U.S. markets were closed for the holiday. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba are our engineers. Next time, the end of carbon as we know it?
As sure as I'm going to get up tomorrow morning, it's not a guarantee. I think I will. We're going to have carbon mandates.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Enjoy your holiday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.